Okay, we can go to United States v. Williams.
May it please the Court, Gail Ivins appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant David Williams. Presented today for the Court, we have kind of a big record but a fairly narrow issue. And that has to do with the standard under Rule 11D2B and what is a fair and just reason to allow withdrawal of a guilty plea.
And as I understand it, it's only for certain of the plea. It's not for withdrawing the refusal to allow him to withdraw the plea for tax evasion.
Correct? That's correct, Your Honor. I did not challenge those on appeal.
And you don't challenge that there was sufficient evidence to support that guilty plea?
That there was sufficient evidence in the entire record, I do not challenge that. And also, a list of things I don't challenge are the credibility findings made by Judge Fisher with respect to the testimony of the two defense attorneys, William and Gabriel Cohan. Although I don't challenge her credibility findings, I do think that the evidence of what they did say about what they did know and their interpretation of the availability defenses is relevant to the issues before the Court today.
All right. Could you tell us exactly what defense you think existed and wasn't encompassed within the record as a whole? First of all, are you contending that the judge shouldn't have relied on the 4 days of testimony?
Correct. In terms of the narrow question
why
before
not?
Her.
I mean, isn't there lots of case law that says that he can look at the whole record?
For purposes of deciding if standing alone there's an adequacy in terms of the factual basis for a plea, when the question in the Court of Appeal is, was it okay, is that plea okay? Was the plea okay, right? So I get a case on appeal and I look at the plea agreement and the record before the Court and the colloquy with the defendant and I say, hey, there's not enough there for a factual basis. This Court says, counsel, we're looking at the entire record. That is a very specific analysis when we're challenging directly the sufficiency of the plea. This is a different question. This question is, was there a fair and just reason to allow the plea to be withdrawn? And if we're looking at that, I think we should look at, for purposes of the question of whether with proper advice and with the right information he would have chosen to go to trial, we should look at what was in the plea agreement, some of which was inaccurate.
But what's underlying this is the lawyer's belief and communication to him that he had no viable defense, and for that purpose, why does someone look at the whole record?
For the question of whether he did or did not have a viable defense, then I think the judge is looking at the entire record, including the testimony of the two lawyers, obviously, and right. what they did at trial, what they said in their opening statement. And so for purposes of that, the lawyers clearly, based on their own statements in the 302, which the Court accepted as their direct testimony, they did not ever consider or understand that by the terms of the private placement memo for SSIF, the money could be transferred to a real estate company without having to secure that with a recorded lien.
Well, I understand the part about the security, but what about everything? Certainly the client knew.
He signed a plea agreement that, he knew a lot. His testimony is so all over the place.
So are you relying solely, principally, or somewhat on this lien question?
Somewhat on the lien question, yes, Your Honor. That there is one of the things that is different, right? When we're looking at the question of whether there's a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea, one of the things that the courts have said is there should be something different, right? There should be something different than what happened at the time of the plea. There should be something new and different we're now looking at, not just, I changed my mind, I've had a change of heart, I wish I hadn't have done it. And one thing that is new and different, at the time of the motion to withdraw the plea is the fact that we now know that this statement about the lien is false. So that is a new and different thing that we have.
Well, except that it was sitting there in everybody's face with regard to this actual document.
That's true, but everyone accepted that it was true at the time. So the fact that they were wrong did not come out until after.
But it doesn't appear that, I mean, it appears that the lawyer's advice was based on what happened at the trial, which had nothing to do with this problem, but with the fact that his explanation for why he had this house and why he got was taking all this money out was disproven by witnesses.
So at ER 469, William Cohen is reported to have said that he thought, you know, that this was the, you know, that the PPM was just not going to help him because of what the court just said. But there is nothing in the record of their understanding, either Gabriel or William Cohan, where they understand this idea that if when the money went from National Finance Bank or whatever to the account, First Republic account of SSIF, if there was no intent to defraud at that moment, then there's no guilt. And then when
okay,
the money
but I
went,
looked at that in terms of the time.
Hmm?
The actual wiretaps, wires, some of them were the payments by investors. And some of them were after, for example, this big, you know, expensive party and after he moved into the house and after he spent all the money, right? So his notion, because I was at first somewhat taken with this concerned about the fact that he, what he said was at some point I developed, but the point was clearly before the wires.
So the three counts that he pled guilty to, 3, 4, and 5, all occurred in January of 2008.
Right, and wasn't when did he move into the house?
He put the earnest money down in June, about the same time he opened up.
Of 2007.
Of 2007.
And when did he move all the furniture in and all that?
He's definitely doing all that, but that piece of it, so if when he is transferring the money from SSF to WFG, and if we accept my position in the briefing that because it owned real estate, it's a real estate company. And so
well, I mean, it's a little far-fetched. First of all, what real estate did it own?
Pardon?
What real estate did it own?
Glenside.
Wasn't that highly debatable whether it owned it? Because sometimes he represented that he owned it and sometimes he represented
well,
it.
Well,
it
had been quit-claimed to WFG. So WFG was the owner of
yeah, but then he would use it for credit purposes and so on as his own.
There is no question that there
the bottom line being that this was an alter ego, essentially.
That is certainly what Judge Fisher found, but the question here is not the sufficiency of the government's evidence. The question is whether there's a fair and just reason to allow withdrawal of the plea. And to do that, we have to show you know, something within the line of things that this court has accepted as reasons to allow the withdrawal of the plea, and one of those would be, in this case, the lawyers did not understand that there was a defense based on the fact that the transfers from SSIF to Williams Financial Group were technically to a real estate company. Now, the court is right that there is a lot of misuse of money that happens in this case, but we are focused on three counts of wire fraud. And for those three counts of wire fraud, it matters.
Why exactly?
Because if his statement in the guilty plea doesn't give a time, the government's argued that well, even if he decided later that
yes,
he, you
but
know,
but the evidence did, and the did give a time. I mean, first of all, the indictment gives a time
yes.
as to when the wires
starting
were.
No later than June 2007.
And the evidence at the trial showed that he was using this money profligately before these wire transfers. So the sum time, I can't understand why it matters.
If at the time that he transferred that money to Williams Financial Group, which was, you know, memorialized with the promissory notes at, I think it's 626 in the excerpt
I thought
record,
that wasn't never recorded.
They weren't recorded.
Right.
But they exist, and they were exhibits in the government's case, and they're in the excerpt of record. So if at the time he's transferring it as a loan to Williams Financial Group, at that point what he does with it from Williams Financial Group, you know, is problematic, but it is not necessarily wire fraud because there is no indication that at the time he's doing that, he wasn't doing it with the intent to develop one or more of these properties for the benefit of the investors.
When did he do that?
When
did he transfer the money from SSIF to...
All during that time period.
Right. Well, so there is evidence that he was doing it because at the same time, he was taking all this money out, you know, millions of dollars for himself.
Yes, and if I were arguing sufficiency of the evidence, I would clearly
but
lose.
It's not about sufficiency of the evidence. It's about his intent, i.e. he was simultaneously putting money in and taking it out for himself, and that's not consistent with the offer.
And if the motion for new trial, they've made an argument that had he known that there was a defense available under the PPM, that he would not have pled guilty, and the question is that a sufficient reason? I see my time is
well
out.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Carolyn Small on behalf of the United States. During the defendant's Rule 11 colloquy in this case, he said he understood the nature of the charges against him, he understood the possible consequences of a plea, including the maximum sentence that he could receive, and he said that he was pleading guilty because he did all the things described in the facts section of the plea agreement. And he also said that he was, quote, very satisfied with the representation that was provided by his trial attorneys and that he believed that they fully considered any defense that he may have to the charges. Now, when the defendant moved to withdraw his plea, he went back on pretty much everything he said during the plea colloquy. He said there wasn't a factual basis for the plea, and he said that his trial attorneys coerced him into pleading guilty. And so the district court held a two-day evidentiary hearing on the defendant's motion, and the district court discredited all of the factual assertions that were underlying the defendant's motion to withdraw his plea.
Asked what he was told by the lawyers.
I'm sorry?
As to what he was told by the lawyers.
Correct, except to the extent that the lawyers told him that their defense strategy that they had planned was not likely to be persuasive to a jury. The court found that the lawyers probably had told him that and that that was likely good advice under the circumstances. But the court found that the lawyers had not otherwise coerced him to plead guilty. In fact, the trial attorneys, the court found, investigated the defendant's defense based on the PPM. In fact, they flew out to New York to speak with the attorney that drafted it, and that the trial attorneys didn't advance it because they couldn't get corroboration on key points. The court also found that the trial attorneys were fully prepared for trial, as evidenced by the fact that they had gone to trial for 4 days, made opening statements, brought pretrial motions, cross-examined witnesses, and the court found, as I mentioned, that the trial attorneys had appropriately advised the defendant that the defense case that they had planned to put forth probably wasn't going to be persuasive in light of the government's witnesses who testified extensively that the Woodbridge property that the defendant had purchased was for his own personal use and not for an investment purpose.
And it wasn't purchased.
It was never purchased, correct, that he had attempted to acquire.
All right, but my understanding is that the contention that this was a real estate company is based not on the Woodbridge property but on the Glenside property.
Right. It's based on the WFG holding company that the defendant had formed, which held a piece of real estate. And so what I take the defense is that we should only look to the point that the defendant transferred the money from the investors and into the WFG account, and we should look no further than that because WFG was a real estate company because it owned a single piece of real estate, and that's where the inquiry ends. That's my understanding of what the purported defense is. But, of course, here we have overwhelming evidence that the defendant immediately transferred the money from that holding company to personal expenses, including the Woodbridge property, including his own. He paid his personal American Express expenses. He paid for a lavish party for his wife. He paid for mortgage on his own property that he and his family were living in, I believe, on Dillinge. And so that is not a defense that the trial attorneys were completely unaware of. They said they testified about that at the district court, that they were asked about this defense, and they said we didn't see that as any real type of defense, that you can put money temporarily into a shell, what it was essentially a shell company, and then immediately transfer it for your personal use. They didn't think that that was an argument that was really a defense to the wire fraud that was charged.
So before us, the claim is that this was a failure to understand the defense, that transferring the money to WFG constituted a loan to a real estate company, right?
Correct.
But in the district court, that's not the defense. That's not what they argued, is it?
No, that's right. And so in the district court, what the defendant argued was that the trial attorneys had coerced him into pleading guilty. And as part of that coercion argument, they said a number of things, that the sentencing had been grossly misrepresented by the trial attorneys, the sentencing exposure. They said that they had given up on the defendants, or the trial attorneys had given up on the defendants. They weren't pursuing any defenses for him. They didn't pursue this PPM defense. And all of that was really part of the coercion argument. And that is what the evidentiary hearing was geared towards. That is what the district court's decision was geared towards.
So if I have really then a plain error standard to apply to this issue, don't I?
Yes.
Since it wasn't argued?
Correct. Yes.
What is the burden that the defense has in order to, if you will, withdraw the plea?
Do you mean, I don't know if it's, I would imagine it's preponderance of the
evidence. Well, don't they have to show that a plausibly motivated, reasonable person in the defendant's position would not have pleaded guilty?
Oh, yes. That is the standard. When the defendant is raising an argument that they were misadvised, the standard is that they have to demonstrate that proper legal advice would have plausibly motivated a reasonable person in the defendant's position to plead guilty.
Why would this not fit that?
I mean, this, well, first there's this threshold factual issue about whether the defendant was in fact misadvised, and I think there are factual findings here.
Well, he was misadvised to the degree that everybody seemed to think that there was this error in the PPM about the lien, and there wasn't.
Right. There was a factual error in the PPM that was...
Not in the PPM.
In the plea. Right. In the plea. And really that was...
In the plea, in the indictment, in the plea colloquy, and so on.
Right. And that was really an error that was sort of ancillary to the core of the fraud. So there were a number of...
The main fact of the fraud is what?
The main fact of the fraud is that the defendant collected money from prospective investors, told the investors that this money was going to be used to invest either directly or indirectly in real estate or real estate companies. And then instead of doing that, the defendant took the money and spent it on himself.
So you're suggesting then that the PPM issue is, I think your word was ancillary?
Right, ancillary, yes. It is. There were a number of misrepresentations that were alleged in the indictment and that were incorporated into the plea agreement. There were a number of things that the plea agreement went through that said the defendant made all of these misrepresentations. One of those misrepresentations was this error in the... So
how do I determine, given the standard of review, that this would not have changed his mind?
Well, I think the court... So the error was that the money, the investor's money, would be secured by a lien, and in fact, I think the PPM said that the investor's money would be secured by the assets of the Sherwood Fund. So in some way, they were supposed to be secured, whether it was by a lien on the investment property or a lien on the assets. I don't know that that makes a difference.
Well, that seems to make a big difference, because the assets of the investment fund may dissipate, which they did. I understand this was right at the time of the crash, but you still have a building there, which has some value. Seems like there's a difference between zero and something.
Right, and that, I mean, that's true, but I mean, really, that whole issue, again, was really, I think getting back to Judge Smith's question about whether it would motivate somebody to plead guilty, I guess the question then is, would it motivate somebody who's been through 4 days of trial and has a mountain of evidence that they did not use the money that was taken to make any investments in real estate, But there is sort of this side issue that they could have said, well, the PPM said it should have been secured by the assets of the Sherwood Fund, which it wasn't secured in any way. It wasn't, none of the promissory notes were ever recorded. I don't think under those facts, I think the court could say as a legal matter that it would not have plausibly motivated a reasonable person.
As I understand his argument, it is, leaving this part aside, it's that this was a real estate company because it owned this one house, which I gather is debatable, but it's at least debatable whether it owned that house.
Right.
Right. And he says, with regard to security, that that house was security for whatever he was doing with the money. In other words, if this entity was loaning him money and he was spending all this money even profligately, because the house at that point could, if sold, would bring that money back, there was no problem. That is my understanding of the core of the argument.
Well, I think that the district court really hit the nail on the head when it said that doesn't, the fact that the investors maybe potentially could have recovered despite the defendant's fraud, that doesn't mean that the defendant didn't commit fraud. It just means that there could have been a potential that they could have recovered their money anyway. And so just the mere fact that there was this potential collateral, I mean, the point of an investment is not just to recover on the collateral in the event that you're defrauded or that your investment isn't used in the way that you've intended.
Does he claim that the money that he took out of WRG or whatever it's called was a loan to him? Is that what he was claiming?
I think he said that the money was a loan from the investors and it was loaned to WFG, but then he clearly used it for himself. I don't know that he ever said that the
He doesn't say that the money that he took out was a loan?
My understanding is it's just from the, no, I don't think that he ever said
that.
Well,
then what difference could the security make anyway? I mean, if he couldn't pay it back, the money that he was taking, he never said he was going to pay the money back. Did he ever say he was going to pay back the money that he took out?
No. I mean, our position is that this was a fraudulent appropriation.
I know it's your position, but I'm trying to figure out what his position is.
I don't think he ever said that he intended to pay the money back once it came to him and he was spending it on this interior designer and on a personal assistant. I think he just called it a loan from that first transfer from the investors to WFG. I don't think he ever said he intended to pay it back once it moved from WFG to his own pockets.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In 2007, I'm sure he thought that he was going to buy the $7.2 million home next door to Miley Cyrus for $6.3 million and make a killing. But that doesn't really matter. What matters is that the lawyers did not understand.
But he apparently thought he was going to live in it, not sell it.
And in the SEC testimony, he said that hadn't been decided. And, you know, he bought Glenside personally and then quit claimed it to WFG. I mean, the facts are sort of all over the place. He obviously could not have been living in all the houses he was buying, and they would have been sold or rented, and they would have lived in one of them. And if he had had to sell the Woodside property, then he would have sold that and moved back to Dilling. But the problem is, before all of that got played out, you know, we had the crash, and so we have all those bad things that happened.
Right, but I don't understand, just as a walkthrough, and leaving aside the mistake about the lien, how he thought that taking all this money out of the intermediary fund, that it was a real estate company, even though he was taking basically all of his assets out and spending it on himself.
And leaving Glenside behind, which was owned by Williams Financial Group,
and
which
so
at
what?
The time was worth, you know, $3 or $4
and
million.
So what? The point was that it said that the money he was taking out was not a loan. It was just, and the representation was that it was going to invest in real estate companies, right. And 10% would be something else.
Could be, yes.
So if you have a company that is 75% of it is going directly to him and 25% of it is the value of his house, then why is that a real estate company?
Right. Your Honor, I understand this is a very narrow and technical argument. I'll do it one more time, and then I'll forgive you if you don't like it. But SSIF...
That's the best part. You're going to forgive us.
And I'll understand. But SSIF is the entity which is the wire fraud is charged about, right. The three counts that he pled to.
And he invested in this company, which...
And it allows, an investment in a real estate company.
Right.
And WFG, which is wholly owned by David Williams and which has one asset, which is the Glenside property, which is at the time worth multiple million dollars.
But isn't the easy answer that it's not a real estate company because 75% of it is going directly to him?
But at the moment that this is all happening, it has an asset that covers all of that. So it's like
the question isn't the moment that the money's going from SSIF to WRG. The question is the what's charged as wire fraud is the investment by the investors in SSIF. And if he knows at the time that wire is being transfer is occurring, that in fact this thing that he's putting the money into isn't really a real estate company because it's really a front for him, isn't that the end of everything?
But it's not just that it's a front for him. He wholly owns that company, and it has one asset. WFG.
Well, so it has a second asset, a fund of money that he then takes out for himself.
That's correct. But to the extent that the loans were proper, then he is the owner of the company, took money out of that company that he wholly owns, and then used it some for making improvements at Glenside, which admittedly took forever to flip, some for trying to purchase Woodbury, the other property, some for paying money. I mean, he definitely used all that money, some on real estate purposes and some not, but the narrow argument that I'm making, in addition to the fact that there was a false statement in the indictment and the plea agreement, which I think gives us a basis to withdraw the plea, based on the analysis that Judge Smith put forward, that he might not have entered a plea had he understood that was an incorrect statement, is that the transfers to WFG, which everyone said, including his lawyers, was wrong, was actually permitted. And that's it. That's what I have.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you both for your argument. United States versus William is submitted. We will go to...